Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, bringing you the Heretics Hour live this Monday, February 6, 2012, broadcast from Voice of Reason Network. Once again, I have a very good show for you, so stay with me for the next 2 hours. After I do my reading from the fire in this first segment, Christine Miller will join me for the rest of the program. Before I start the book reading, I want to read you an email I received the day after last week's show from a regular listener in England. She writes, "Dear Carolyn, you mentioned that you had little feedback, on your weekly reading of the fire, the bombing of Germany, 1940 to 1945. Well, I have found it both highly informative and spine-chilling. Every Anglo-Saxon should have a copy and read it to their children. I'm not ashamed to admit to tears of anger and disgust as I listen. I have read extensively about the bombing of Dresden, but this was new. So keep reading, no matter how unpalatable it is, knowing what we did." She continues, "I have a personal interest in World War II from a British viewpoint. A close relative, who I'll just give his first name, Jack, was a navigator in the elite RAF Pathfinder squadron. On the night he died, December 16, 17, 1943, known as Black Thursday, Bomber Command lost 70 planes and 327 men. 25 planes were lost over Berlin, but 31 planes were lost attempting to land back at base in fog. The meteorological forecast for the raid had given out fog and low cloud, totally unsuitable for a mission. Many of the planes ran out of fuel. Jack's plane did and crashed into the field at the end of the runway, and as with most Lancasters, caught fire. There were only two survivors. The system did not have the capacity to cope with the return of large numbers of bombers, and least of all in fog or bad weather, certainly not in 1943. Churchill's policy was to carry on regardless, no matter how many lives were wasted. Bomber Command, that is, Bomber Harris, could have saved lives by redirecting returning planes to other fog-free bases, but were totally negligent in their duty. Pilots and crew knew how costly the Lancasters were." She says they were 59,000 pounds each, and I don't know if that was at that time, probably. In 1943, not now. Well, of course, they don't make them anymore now. And it was a matter of pride to return their kite to base. The fact that parachutes were often unreliable may also have been a factor. She finishes off, I mentioned this to show another aspect of how callous our so-called leaders were in sacrificing the cream of our fighting forces. It would appear that nothing has changed except that the adversary is stronger and more confident." And by adversary, she has a capital A. She doesn't mean the Germans. I think you can imagine who she means. So I really want to thank this lovely listener for writing that. I told her I was going to ask her if I could read it. She said yes. And I also heard from a couple others who also told me that they were enjoying it and to keep reading. So I will do that. And I'm going to start tonight in this first segment with more on how the British justified what they did, including now a little bit comes in from the Church of England and bishops and archbishops. And after America entered the war and supplied more material, where it... You know, this is mostly about 1943 now. So I will start here on page 77. The United States officially became part of the hostilities on December 11, 1941, thanks to Hitler's declaration of war. The strategy that it laid down with the British in January 1943 consisted of a combined bomber offensive of the two air forces. The U.S. 8th Air Force had already been on British bases for 3 months, gathering its strength. At the Casablanca Conference, now the Casablanca Conference was January 14th to 24th, 1943, the very beginning of 43. The attendees were Roosevelt, Churchill, Field Commander Eisenhower, and British Field Commander, Field Marshal Alexander. Stalin had been invited, but he was dealing with the Battle of Stalingrad at home and didn't come. The decision to demand unconditional surrender was made here already in January 43. This showed they had no desire to end the war, but to break the back of their opponents. That was my explanation of the Casablanca Conference. At this conference, the point-blank directive drafted an air offensive that, except for half a sentence, included about a dozen pages listing the industries to be crushed: U-boat, aircraft, and military transport vehicle manufacture, ball bearings, oil supply, and synthetic rubber and tires. The remaining half sentence mentioned the, quote, undermining of the morale of the German people to a point where their capacity for armed resistance is fatally weakened, unquote. This was listed under point one, which was called a mission. Excuse me. Point two was named the principal objectives. It referred to 76 precision targets within the six industries mentioned above in point one. Now, point six was effectiveness of the 8th Air Force. The 8th Air Force was, as far as I know, the one that did all the bombing for the United States in Europe in World War II. It was this point six definitively established the fact that it is possible to conduct precision pattern bombing operations against selected precision targets from altitudes of 20,000 to 30,000 feet in the face of anti-aircraft, artillery, and fighter defenses. We'll see how possible this, how realistic this was. Point five was the general plan of operations, and it named a radius of 1,000 feet within which the necessary hit accuracy was to be achieved. This basically described the accuracy of the oboe bomb aiming system, which was a targeting system that the British had developed. But its range covered only the Ruhr Basin area up to and including Wuppertal. The Casablanca Conference had agreed upon making the Ruhr Basin the primary target. While the U.S. forces were still drilling, Harris was preparing for the Battle of the Ruhr in the spring. That would be spring 43 now. For those of you who might not know, the Ruhr Basin, as it was called, was an area in far western Germany that was bordering northern Belgium and southern Netherlands. And it's the Rhine River and branches off to some others. There's a lot of water there and, you know, rivers and a lot of cities, a lot of industrial development. So that's what they were aiming at, and it wasn't very deep into Germany either. The offensive against the arsenal of the Reich, as the Ruhr was called, involved the bombing of 21 major cities between March and July 1943. After the raid on Essen on the night of March 12th, London papers printed five-column photographs of the destroyed Krupp factory. The correspondent of a Swedish trade and shipping newspaper cabled home that 15 huge production shops were destroyed or severely damaged. The administration buildings looked like an empty honeycomb. The largest foundry brings to mind aerial photographs of Pompeii, he said. Pompeii, you know, was that Roman city way back then in Italy that was totally covered by a volcano. Continuing, the Krupp factory in Essen spread out over an area of 175 square miles. The grounds were not contiguous, but the 1,000-foot radius set in the point-blank directive made it possible to destroy quite a bit of it. Aerial photographs showed an area of destruction covering 148 acres at Krupp and 7.7 square miles in the city from the main train station to Alten Essen. Now, that, how does that compare with the 1,000 square feet that they said they were going to be able to target with no problem? From the height of 20 to 30,000 feet. Krupp was hit by 125 high-explosive bombs and 20,000 incendiaries. A direct hit struck the fuse factory, whose production was moved to Auschwitz. Panzer construction, shop number 3, was also destroyed, so production of the Panther and Tiger models had to be postponed by 2 months. Crankshaft production also suffered appreciable delays and was moved to Silesia. In this case, the armaments economy did not endure a Pompeii, just a never-ending series of pinpricks. Parallel to that was a never-ending series of repairs. While the military machine was becoming industrialized, industry was also becoming militarized. Losses were part and parcel of it. It was possible to patch things together, relocate battalions, and arrange substitute workers. Industry no longer complained about damages as it would have in peacetime. It had become a war zone. Causing and balancing out damages was itself a raging battle, one with uncertain results. Wars, said Marshal Ferdinand Foch, the victor, the French, the victor of 1918, are won with whatever is left. Bomber Command lost 5% over Essen. The crews were horrified to discover precision flak artillery that reached an altitude of 23,000 feet. The flak had better shoot-down rate this time than the fighters did, the fighter planes, whose Focke-Wulf 190s gave the heavy Wellingtons especially a hard time. Two of them collided in midair. Another fired 750 shots at a pursuer that attacked 3 times before it escaped. Speed was everything in the bedlam. No one thought about a point target, in accordance with Casablanca standards, within a 1,000-foot radius. Something like that was pure fantasy. Initially, the Pathfinders had taken good measurements and marked out a 7.5 first wave of bombers. Subsequent waves, blinded by the searchlight cones chasing them down, saw a smoldering, fiery oven miles below them, and if they were calm enough, aimed into it. The whole Duisburg area seemed ablaze with incendiaries, reported a Lancaster pilot about the night raid on April 26th. The glare from them was so intense that it was difficult to pick out ground details. We dropped out our bombs as the white glare was turning to red, showing that the fires had caught and were beginning to spread. I'm going to skip a paragraph here. That's a little bit technical, probably interesting, but and continue here. Air Secretary Sinclair, that's the British, of course, sufficiently answered all the questions of the House of Commons on March 31st as regards definitions. He said, "The targets of Bomber Command are always military, but night bombing of military objectives necessarily involves bombing the area in which they are situated." Harris considered this to be a roundabout answer, as if they had reason to feel ashamed. The government insisted on publicly denying any indiscriminate bombing of civilian centers. On the other hand, neither did it claim to be destroying only military targets. It was emphasized that the targets they destroyed were of military significance. As Deputy Prime Minister Clement Attlee of the Labour Party also assured Parliament, as has been repeatedly stated in the House, he said, the bombing is of those targets which are most effective from the military point of view. From a military point of view, it was most effective to destroy a city, including all that lived, worked, and was produced therein. The Battle of the Ruhr, a product of the 1,000-foot precision protocol declared in Casablanca, killed 21,000 people. The cities that were set on fire were Dusseldorf, Krefeld, Remscheid, and Wuppertal. Each of them mourned more than 1,000 casualties. Of the 14,000 buildings in Remscheid, 11,000 had been destroyed or damaged by the end of the last raid in the Ruhr campaign on the night of July 30th. 83% of this city of 95,000, that's not all that big, 95,000, had been devastated by 273 planes. The anti-aircraft teams had been paralyzed by the tinfoil strip. They watched from outside town how the city turned red with flames. When residents staggered out of air raid shelters at 11:45 p.m. after the all-clear had sounded, they saw a city of ruins that could not yet free itself from destruction. The incendiary matter wanted to finish its job. It enveloped the city in a firestorm 90 minutes after Bomber Command had left. Sorry. The reports published in the British press, such as the headline Night Bombers Crush Krefeld in the Times of June 23, 1943, denied the government information regarding the nature of the targets that were bombed. Accounts in the Times stated that the city was shrouded in black smoke for miles, extending 15,000 feet high, after five 4,000-pound blockbuster bombs had been dropped on it each minute for three-quarters of an hour. Imagine that. Readers were told the next day that not targets, but cities had been crushed. Within Bomber Command, the facts were treated openly. In the immediate assessment of damage report, based on aerial photographs, the balance of the raid on Krefeld on the night of June 21, 1943, was reported as follows. Now, this is the private report within Bomber Command. 25,000 residences destroyed, 87,000 people homeless, and 1,450 people killed, 850 by high-explosive bombs and 600 by incendiaries. The casualties were undoubtedly viewed as having contributed to the success of the operation. The estimates were slightly high, yet still amazingly accurate. Krefeld actually suffered 1,056 deaths, an area of 925 acres became a closed fire zone, and 47% of the built-up area was burned out totally. One raid, 47%. The Battle of the Ruhr proved Bomber Command's... skip that. Part, probably good too, but can't read the whole book. Continued a little couple paragraphs later, the British public in 1943 and 1944 demonstrated a widening gap between a general knowledge about the progress of the war and actually knowing what was going on. Knowing what was going on involved understanding the complexities that occurred but were generally not supposed to, and which were necessary but not right. The press reported extensively on the massive destruction of German cities and cited RAF communiques that the columns of smoke could be seen as far away as Holland. Bomber Command's assessments of the successful killing were omitted, but Londoners were veterans of bombing too. They could figure out on their own the connection between burned-out homes and incinerated inhabitants. After Bomber Command's beacon of fire in July 1943, the word Hamburgization was coined in the fall. 90% of people polled, this is in Britain, in 1944, nevertheless claimed not to know that German city centers were being bombed. City center can mean different things. Harris viewed it as the building material most vulnerable to fire and well-suited for igniting. The mass quarters, where the will to resist was... Will to resist was most consolidated, lay in the ring surrounding the center. Workers had to be softened up. Nothing more needed to be said. At a time when human casualties became 4- and 5-digit figures, statistics stopped being mentioned. Ever since the Germans bombed London, everyone knew how people got buried in rubble. The dispute of the Church of England marked the final line of Christian defense. As early as 1940, pacifist clerics had asked the archbishops of Canterbury in York at what point the church would rather lose a war than win it through methods that cannot be reconciled with Christianity. The bishops answered that such a case would be the bombing of undefended cities, not as reprisal, but as regular policy. Since all cities defended themselves against bomber command with at least a couple of anti-aircraft cannons, this argument could withstand a lot, since they were therefore, of course, not actually undefended. But it was not the most serious argument put forth to support the bombing of civilians. When the annihilation bombings got serious in 1943, Archbishop Cyril Garbett of York recited the justification of a just war from St. Augustine. And he said, often in life, there is no clear choice between absolute right and wrong. Frequently, the choice has to be made of the lesser of two evils, and it is a lesser evil to bomb a war-loving Germany than to sacrifice the lives of our fellow countrymen who long for peace and to delay delivering millions now held in slavery. Now, can you believe that they could convince themselves that these Germans were being held in slavery, or were they just meaning non-Germans that happened to be held in slavery? I don't know. But I will go on. Then Bishop George Bell of Chichester got involved, and he was a little more serious about it. There's quite a bit here that he said and read in Parliament or in the House of Lords, and he attacked what was going on. But I'm going to move so I can get all this, so I can get the rest of this in. He said, Bishop Bell, the author writes, Bishop Bell considered what he called exaggerated bombing of military targets to be legally questionable. He was talking about the legal aspects of it. But Freeman Dyson, a physicist at the Operational Research Center in Bomber Command, knew better. Morale bombing did not exaggerate the targeting of military complexes. A city was not a target, as these were defined in the Casablanca Conference list. It was and is a space where people resided, worked, and lived. And the space was to be damaged such that as little as possible of that space remained. Because the completed weapon, as it existed in 1943, could not accomplish that in one fell swoop, Cologne had to suffer 262 times, Essen 272 times, Dusseldorf 243 times, and Duisburg 299 times. That's how many times they had air raids coming over their city and dropping bombs. I felt sickened by what I knew, wrote Dyson in 1984. Many times I decided I had a moral obligation to run out into the streets and tell the British people what stupidities were being done in their name. But I never had the courage to do it. I sat in my office until the end, carefully calculating how to murder most economically another 100,000 people. I'm going to go a little ahead now, just a couple pages. I'm going to read just one paragraph because he's writing about this flooding project that is fairly well known by a lot of people who are familiar with World War II, of the Mona Dam, which they thought would do tremendous devastation to the German effort. And they managed to bomb this dam and cause a huge flooding and so on. But it didn't do as much harm as they had thought it would. But there's one paragraph here I want to read. It's about anthrax. So 9 months after the flooding project, Lord Cherwell, who I mentioned last week, and I said he was German and Jewish, who had been born and raised in Britain and considered himself English, but someone wrote to me and said he wasn't Jewish, and there are sources that say he was Jewish, but in Wikipedia doesn't, and shows his father to be Catholic and his mother an American Protestant who insisted on raising her children as Protestants. So anyway, I don't know what he was, but this is the guy named Lindemann, Frederick Lindemann, who became Lord Cherwell. He described to the Prime Minister, Churchill, how anthrax bacteria work. By the winter of 1943, a 4-pound bomb filled with anthrax spores, given the codename N, had been designed by the British and built by the Americans. Half a dozen Lancasters could apparently carry enough, if spread evenly, to kill anyone found within a square mile and to render the area inhabitable thereafter. Churchill responded without delay. This would solve the bothersome problem of precision targeting. On March 8, 1944, he ordered 500,000 anthrax bombs from the United States. "Pray let me know when they will be available," he wrote to the Bacteriological Warfare Committee. "We should regard it as a first installment." Well, as it happened, they didn't need to use those, but they were there, they were prepared, and I guess they were prepared in the United States. I have probably just a couple, half a minute, if that. Well, here, no, that's it. So this is where we end tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening to this, and I will be back in 5 minutes after this news break with Christine Miller, and we'll continue with the show. Stay with us.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Iran says it will definitely stop oil exports to quote-unquote certain European countries. The country's oil minister says they have yet to make a decision on cutting supplies to other EU states. It's Tehran's response to the EU's oil embargo that was set to come into force in July. To explain what this could mean and more, we'll talk to Chris Bamery, a political analyst who joins us live from London. So do you think, which certain states do you think Tehran is referring to here?
Well, I think it's obvious that Iran is talking about the United States and the leading powers in the European Union, with Britain, France, and to a lesser extent Germany in the driving seat. And I think they're listening to what's the rhetoric from London, Paris, and Washington, and understand that that rhetoric is being hyped up all the time. I mean, today we've had claims this week from the US Defense Secretary that there was going to be an Iranian terror attack inside the United States, although he also said there was no evidence, they could produce no evidence for that. Today, elsewhere in Tel Aviv, I read a supposedly a respectable commentator saying the Iranians had missiles which they could fire and could hit the United States of America. That claim is just simply preposterous. But we are seeing a ratcheting up of the anti-Iranian rhetoric in the West. And at the same time, the Iranians must understand from recent history that the history of sanctions has been in both former Yugoslavia and in the case of Iraq, has been to soften up those countries in preparation for a military assault, particularly in the case of Iraq, where really 10 years of sanctions beggared the economy. And that is what people like William Hague, Hillary Clinton, people have talked about, that sanctioning, stopping Iran's oil industry through these economic and financial sanctions could hit the Iranian economy and thus undermine the regime. And at the same time, the Iranians must be very, very nervous about the American build-up inside the Persian Gulf. If you look at the map of Iran, it is surrounded by American military bases. Incidentally, bases which are also aimed at Russia and China. So I think in some ways the pressure must be on inside Iran to think we should maybe get a retaliation in first. And I also think that this is a very dangerous situation. The militarization of the Straits of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf can lead to accidental clashes. And we can remember a supposed accident back in 1987 when an American warship, the Valencian, shot down an Iranian civilian airliner with a loss of 290 deaths. There have been a number of incidents like that over the years. And it could just take something to trigger it here. So we're in a very dangerous point. And I think in the West, people in the United States and in Europe should be asking their governments to pull back from talk of military action, to pull back from sanctions, and to start talking to Tehran. And I think it's very important that people in the West actually put this demand, because the Iranians...
let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm very pleased to have Christine Miller with me. Now, she lives in Wisconsin, but she spent the first about 20 years of her life in her birthplace, Germany, and the 10 years, Chris, well, first, let me just say hello, Chris. Come on and say hello.
Hello.
Now, you spent the first 10 years of your life
under the Nazis.
Under the Nazis, yes, under the Third Reich, and then the next 10 years in the Federal Republic.
Right.
Right. And you were in, you lived in Bavaria. You lived
right.
in this, yeah, I'm going to ask you about your hometown. We'll do that when we talk about your article. So I was just reading, let's see what else I want to say about you. You have been a teacher for many years, and you were married and raised a family in Wisconsin, and you started writing letters to the editor. You know, you've been on the program. I think our listeners know, they know you, and you've been on twice before. This is your third time on my program. So, we talked about how you ran for, you're still running for the school board. We'll talk about that later. You're very active. You don't just think things and say things. You do things. You're really a real model, I think, of the way we should all behave. And, another thing I want to say about you before I say I don't miss it is that, you know, I think you have a trait that you're not fooled by anything. I see you as somebody who sees right through everything. You have an innate truth meter, and you respond to it, and you don't mind saying what you really think. I think all of this is just great, and it's in your writing. We're going to talk about your writing. But first, you know, I was just reading From the Fire, and I was during the break, we were talking about that a little, and you said that you did ask me if I knew about the potato beetle, because I was talking about how I ended up with the anthrax, you know, bombs. And I said, no, tell us about it. So tell us whatever you want to tell us about that and the bombing that you experienced and what you experienced during those years.
But the potato beetles, we are told, you know, say allies, I don't know if the English or the Americans, they are going to drop potato beetles on us. And so we kids had to go out into the potato fields and look for the beetles. And actually, we had great fun in the furrows running up and down and playing hide and seek. And there was no potato beetles. Well, lo and behold, suddenly the potato beetles were there. And I felt very much put out because picking potato beetles, the potato beetles are, it's a raspberry beetle, but the larvae are ugly. So we had to get out and patrol the potato fields. And it wasn't very much fun anymore. So what we were told, you know, in the beginning we made fun of it, but everything came true what we were told.
Well, are you saying that the potato beetles were actually, or this potato beetle plague was actually started by the British?
Right.
It was. I've never read about that.
I do not know who dropped the potato beetles, but before that, all of Germany, there were no potato beetles. Potato beetles were completely unknown. And then that must have been biological warfare. Because, you know, the potato crop in these hard times was a very, very important crop.
Sure.
And naturally at this time, there were no pesticides or anything like that. So, we went out and had to pick the beetles.
And the beetles were on the green part of the plant, right? Above ground.
Yes.
All right.
I don't know. Do you know how a potato beetle
Yes,
looks
because
like?
I was good at, no, I don't know a potato beetle. I don't think is I used to be an organic gardener with on a large garden, and and I was out picking stuff, all kinds of stuff. I was doing all kinds of stuff by hand. And one time there was a plague of something that got on the beetle, on the potatoes. We grew a lot of potato plants, there. And, but it wasn't the, it wasn't a beetle, but it was something I, can't think of.
Fungus?
Kind of like a grasshopper. I mean, they came and they just covered everything. And we learned they were coming. And you have to start fires. I didn't know this, but I learned you have to start little fires out in the garden and kind of smoke them out or something. So that's what we were doing. You know, when you don't have pesticides, or in my, this case, I didn't want to use pesticides.
Yeah,
it's a lot of work. And I that was a 24-hour job for me for a couple of years. But I it was a labor of love. It was something I wanted to do.
But you know, as I said before, you know, the Irish had the potato blight, but the Germans had nothing. I mean, the potatoes were healthy and well, and there was no potato blight, and there were no potato beetles. So this potato beetles was dropped down, was introduced by either by the English or by the Americans. I do not know who dropped the potato beetles on us, but they did. It was biological warfare.
And now, so, did they have potato beetles ever after that, once they got them in there?
Well, now naturally, now they spray.
Well, yeah, all right. So then they spray.
So now, well, I grow potatoes too, but I don't spray. Just like you, I'm an organic gardener, so I pick them off, and I mulch my potatoes heavily. So I really, you know, it's not. I don't have too many, and the ones I have, I can pick off.
Yeah, yes. Well, but, there you go. That's how they start. A lot of stuff spread, a lot of things around the world that didn't happen before because of all the, you know, if it isn't war, it's some other kind of economic warfare that's going on, or some kind of competition that's going on, or just shifting people around, and then all these biological things move around the world. Pretty soon everybody's got them. Then we have to do all, then people generally have to just do, chemical spraying and of one kind or another to get rid of them. So, yeah, that's something I've always been very interested in. I get very upset about what's been done to the earth and to soil, but that's not our topic for tonight. So,
okay.
Another thing I wanted to talk about then was, one of your letters that I came upon this week as I was just looking at your website, and your website is C.B. Miller. What is your website again?
Yeah, cbmiller.com.
Okay, cbmiller.com, yes. And these letters, people just can't understand how good they are unless they read them. Now, here's one that I just happened to click on, and I hadn't seen it before. And I wanted you to read it because I think it goes along with what I read about the bombing to some degree. It certainly does. And you said you didn't want to read it because you have an accent. Well, your accent is not that bad at all. You have it there in front of you, or do you not?
I have it right here.
Okay, good. Well, read it to us.
Okay, that letter I wrote to the Marshfield News Herald. It April 8th, 2003. Okay, here I go. Seeing shock and awe on TV perhaps made your heart swell with patriotic pride. Mine constricted in despair. I have too many memories and too many images imprinted which I can't erase. By watching the fireworks, so named by a high school student, an image of the past superimposed itself on the scene, on the screen. About 5 years ago, I took our dog, Jaeger, on my daily walk through our woods. Jaeger, as always, ran with his nose to the ground. I saw him stop and scoop something up. I immobilized the dog between my knees and forced his jaws open. In his mouth was a mouse, unharmed, with three babies clinging to her for safety and protection. I shook the dog's muzzle. The mouse with her babies fell out and disappeared among the debris of the forest floor. I leashed the dog and only released him after I was sure that Jaeger had forgotten about the mouse nest. I do not like mice. They girdle my newly planted white oak seedlings, chew up styrofoam insulation in my chicken coop, and are just a nuisance all around. But when I saved that the mouse and her babies, I did not let varmints go, but a mother and her little ones. Bush and his war supporters do not see children clinging in terror of death to their mothers, who, just like that mouse, are unable to protect and save them. The American administration only sees cheap oil, and the Israeli government nothing but extended territory. Why does my heart constrict in despair? It is not only because I, as a child, like the Iraqi children, desperately wanted the noise of the explosions to stop. It is Orwell's 1984, applied to Iraq. Plundering is aiding. Occupation is freedom. Death is liberation. End of story.
That's you read that excellently, much better than I could have. Thank you so much. Well, what comes to my mind from this? Well, first, yes, I wanted to ask you, and I did ask you, why you named your dog Jaeger. You told me, you reminded me that Jaeger means hunter, which I knew, but I hadn't thought that's why you were. I didn't think of that connection. But that's I like the way you say the name Jaeger, the word Jaeger. I wish I could say it that way.
Okay.
It sounds better. Now, you say here that when you were a child, you wanted the noise of the explosions to stop. Can you tell us just a little bit about what your experience was with bombing?
Well, as I said, I grew up in Münsterhausen, and that was country. Okay, but my mother one time took me to Augsburg, okay, and at Augsburg, and I must have been about, I don't know, five, six, something around that age. Well, and there was a minor attack on Augsburg, okay, this attack, by the way, Augsburg was, afterwards, it was devastated. Mm-hmm. It was bombed severely, but this was a minor attack. And we lived on my grandfather lived on the periphery. And, you know, I was yanked out at night from the bed, and then we all went down the cellar. And, you know, I heard the explosion. And I just, you know, stop it. And when it was done, when we finally... the signal was given that the attack was over, and well, I had peed in my pants.
Oh, and, yes.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you told me this one of the times.
I told you that last time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
well,
also,
I didn't remember.
But also, towards the end of the war, I saw a bombing squadron flying over our house, and they were going into the direction of Ulm. They were bombing Ulm, but the pilots, okay, the airplanes were so low that I could see the pilots in the cockpit, and naturally, for some reason, on the way back, they must have dropped a couple of bombs. But they fell in the woods. So, but again, the explosion, the noise. Mm-hmm. So, I didn't live in the city. So that is my recollection. So,
you survived, and you didn't have the terrible experiences.
No,
that so many
of the,
had
of the kids, in, of the kids in the cities.
Yes, yes.
No, but I just said one time. when my mother took me to Augsburg. And as I said, Augsburg, the death toll was about when it was really bombed. That was towards the end. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It must have been in the spring of 1945. Okay. Then it was very, very heavily damaged, and the death toll was about 800. And that was, Augsburg was at this time not a big city. Mm-hmm. So, and naturally, my father was released from Russia in 1945, November 1945. And then he moved to Pforzheim. And, you know, everybody talks about Dresden, and I don't like that. As if Dresden was the only city which was pulverized. No. They were all the German cities were pulverized. Okay. Dresden actually is what was different with Dresden is that they had so many refugees in there. But, Pforzheim was bombed, okay, February 23rd, 1945. And my father, okay, settled in, and he found a cellar in the city, which he could use. And, he started his shops there, and people said, oh, you are crazy to go into this bombed out area because the rats are going to devour you and you won't be safe. But naturally at that time things were still safe. But so he dug out a basement, a cellar, and he made four rooms out of it. You had to walk down. And so when I visited him then, that must have been 1946 in the summer. And then the city started to stink. I mean, have you ever smelled a decaying?
No, I would not have had an opportunity to smell smell was there.
It's a Swedish nauseating smell. Okay. It smells kind of sweet. So the whole city, you know, they started to stink because, you know, the people couldn't be gotten out from underneath the rubble. And naturally the majority of victims were children. Mm. Because what the people of Pforzheim did, they put on top of the rubble heap, they put, crosses, okay, wooden crosses. And then they put on the crosses were all the names of the people which were still underneath. And the majority were children.
Wow.
So it really was a war against children. And I would say, the men were gone. You know, the men were
it was definitely women and children. That's
yeah,
right.
It was, it's a majority of victims were children and their mothers, okay? But sometimes the enormity of that atrocity, it is so enormous.
That's why they don't want to talk about it, Christine. Well, that's why they try to cover it up and pretend
But even with the Germans, you know, the new generation, it doesn't register on the scale of our emotions anymore. It's too heavy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Well, that's why I'm reading this. Every week now, I'm reading it for a half hour to get at least the people who listen to my program to really understand. And, you know, next week is going to be the anniversary of the Dresden bombing. And I'm going to read the parts in the book about Dresden next week. And when I looked for them, there wasn't that much. And I thought that was very good because this Friedrich is writing a book trying to show how the entire country of Germany was destroyed, not just a couple of cities, the ones that we know, you know, Berlin, Dresden, and Hamburg. And so he doesn't go into any special. You know, he talks about Dresden and gives information about it, but he doesn't spend all that time about it because there's whole books written about Dresden. And this British woman, who you didn't hear my first part, unfortunately, but she said that she knew about Dresden, a listener from England. She's enjoying this, and not enjoying it, but she finds it, you know, important. She knew about Dresden, but she didn't know about all the rest of it. So still today, people don't understand. And the reason I'm doing this, too, is because when I decided I was going to read this book, finally, I'd had it for a while.
What are you reading?
I didn't fully understand The Fire by Jörg Friedrich.
Yeah. But you know,
I didn't understand just how much had been done, just how bad it was. I really didn't.
I only one city was spared. You know, I mentioned that before.
Only one city was spared.
But you know, Carolyn, it wasn't just Germany. I mean, the English. Did you know that the Americans bombed Rome repeatedly?
Oh, sure. Yes, I do know. They did a lot of damage in France. And these people, they're only not complaining about that because it's not politically correct. But the Americans were totally, really irresponsible in what they did. But the British were before that. So, there's a lot we could talk about that, like why they were and what that means and all. But I do want to talk about your article and talk about the First Freedom newspaper. And we're coming to the end of our first hour. So your article in the new First Freedom newspaper that is put out by Olaf Childress, who I had on the program, and I really like him a lot. And this is a very good newspaper. I got a subscription to it, but you can get it online. And I haven't received my paper yet. My mail here in Texas tends to be slow when it comes to periodicals. So, but I can read it online, and so can anybody else. And your essay in there is called Being Accepted Isn't at All Times a Virtue. And I'd like you to start talking about that. We can continue after the break. But just go through some of the... Maybe I'm going to read this first paragraph so people understand. Because I think it is so well written. You're so honest. You write, I still feel ashamed and guilty about an incident which happened in my childhood during first grade at the village elementary school in Munsterhausen, Germany. And you've told us about where that is. It was the morning recess. We were never supervised. And a group of kids decided to beat up on a schoolmate. Eagerly, I looked for a stick to join that fray. The boy was on his back with feet and arms up in the air to ward off the blows. It was a huge class, therefore I didn't know the boy and had no idea why he had to be beaten. I, a gentle girl who had a little graveyard where I buried and mourned drowned little chicks and dead pussycats, I felt and still feel pity for every suffering creature, be it animal or human. And then you go on to discuss... why we do things like that, why we join in on beating up some victim. So what would you say about that in a couple of minutes here until we'll come back to it? How do you explain why you did that?
Shall I wait until I come up?
No, right now. Go ahead and start.
Well, because I wanted to be part of the crowd. I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be in. All I can say, I wanted to be with it. And that was the thing. They all did it, and I wanted to join the fray. And again, I just see the mentality. You know, people just, what is it? Is it an animal instinct? I puzzle about that. Why do people do that? I mean, I did it, but I was still a child, but I did it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, I did some things like that when I was a child too. And when I think back, I think, gee, but I had enough sense to feel bad about it even while it was going on, but I did it anyway, because you're right. There's some kind of a group thing and you want to be part of this people who are in the group who are what they're doing.
You
so,
want to be-
but, but, Yeah, but then you bring up how it's practiced by Catholics, not beating up on someone, but going along. It's a kind of a going along thing.
Yeah, well, and I mean, but by the way, what the Catholic see are sending right now? Okay, it was in the paper just yesterday or the day before yesterday. Well, a high school kids are going to go to Washington to protest to protest the abortions. So they object to abortions going on.
Okay, Christine, we will continue with that when we get back after this 5-minute news break.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
On Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Daniel Renches. The U.S. government says it has suspended operations at its embassy in Syria and has withdrawn its diplomatic staff from the country. The move comes just 2 days after Russia and China vetoed a draft resolution at the UN Security Council calling for political change in Syria. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks says the withdrawal of US diplomats from Syria was carefully planned by the Obama administration.
The State Department says the Syrian government was informed of the decision to close the embassy after U.S. diplomats left the country, including Ambassador Robert Ford. For months now, the U.S. has expressed concern over the safety of U.S. diplomatic staff in Syria, at one point withdrawing the ambassador for lengthy consultations in Washington after the Syrian media accused him of fomenting revolution inside the country. Poland will now represent U.S. diplomatic interests in Syria.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy have displayed a united front in condemning the ongoing violence. During a joint press conference in Paris, the two leaders vowed not to abandon the Syrian people after the UN Security Council failed to pass the resolution. Our Paris correspondent Kate Moody says the French and German leaders insisted that action must be taken against Damascus.
They both condemned Russia and China's decision to veto a UN resolution on Syria this weekend, and they said the international community would not be blocked. The French president said he would be speaking to his Russian counterpart Dmitry Medvedev on behalf of Merkozy, that is on behalf of both France and Germany, and said that the countries would not abandon the Syrian people. Nicolas Sarkozy has in fact proposed creating a Friends of Syria group, which would apparently include several European and Arab countries and the United States, to try and advance the Arab League initiative after it was unable to make headway at the United Nations.
Greece's coalition parties have been given until Monday to tell the European Union whether they'll accept the painful terms of a new bailout deal. Prime Minister Lucas Papademos is continuing talks to get leaders of the three parties in his government to sign off on terms of a $130 billion euro rescue, which Greece needs soon to avoid a chaotic debt default. But a number of major issues with the European Central Bank, the EU and the IMF lenders remain unresolved. Our Europe correspondent Vanessa Mock says it's a tricky political tightrope for Papademos.
It's extremely difficult right now for the Greek Prime Minister because he, on the one hand, is under deadline pressure to avert bankruptcy of his country. He has to get a deal with international lenders to get 130 billion euros. On the other hand, he is facing huge opposition from the country's politicians and unions who say Greece is already on its knees. It's deep in recession. Unemployment is at nearly 20%.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The UN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're now in our second hour, and this is when we have open phone lines. So I want to tell you that the phone number you can call is 1-855-477-2283. My guest is Christine Miller, and we're having a conversation about her right now, her article, her latest, I would call it an essay, in the First Freedom newspaper put out by Olaf Childress. It comes out once a month. It's an actual hold-in-your-hands newspaper, but you can also read it online for free. But it's nice, if you don't order a subscription, you should send a donation for reading it for free. It's filled with lots of good stuff. I mean, it's really excellent, I think. And Christine's been writing it for a while now, or, you know, giving some of her writing to it. So, Christine, go on with where you left off. You were telling us about how a group of high school students from your hometown in Wisconsin, I know the name of the town, but I have the Marshfield, are currently on a trip to Washington, D.C. to protest against abortion. Are they associated with the church group?
Oh, yes.
And then at the same time that you said they were going to be going to the Holocaust Museum.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, the Holocaust has turned into a cult, and that is their place of worship. You know, in the Old Testament, it said, "You shall have no gods, other gods besides me." Well, that's a new god. That's a new god for the Catholics. And I mean, what I wrote in my article is that it is amazing. I mean, Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, they really saved Europe from communism. If communism had been successful in Germany, I do not think that France and Italy could have been held. And where would the church be then? And where would Rome be? Where would the Vatican be? And then to beat up on the Nazis, and they always talk about all the priests which were in prison. That's a lie. I mean, there were a few priests which were in Dachau, but that was... I mean, I knew of no priest who was arrested, and no priest was arrested when he did his priestly duties. Okay, so if a priest was arrested and put into Dachau, then it was either sabotage, espionage, or criminality. So, like, as I mentioned in my article, I talked with a Father Ball, and he got 5 years in prison for what I considered a minor sexual transgression.
Well, explain this a little bit better. Now, we're talking about these students are from a Catholic high school who are going on.
Yeah.
You taught for a while in a Catholic high school, and you were raised a Catholic, as a child and so on. And so you're very familiar with the Catholic Church. And now this Father Ball, I didn't understand, where did you know him?
He was a co-teacher. He taught theology, he taught religion.
Well, when was he imprisoned?
That was afterwards, after I had left. So,
What happened? He was accused of sexual transgression
and... Well, what I considered was minor, but he got 5 years.
Well, what was it?
Well, what he did?
Yes.
Well, he stroked over the fly of a boy who was, he was counseling, something like that. I mean,
There was only this one one person complaining about him.
One.
Well, this is how they have been made to go overboard. Now, some people won't like this because they say, anytime you do anything to a child, that's just horrible, horrible. Now, sometimes you don't know. I guess he he admitted it or something, or he pled guilty to it or whatever. He didn't deny it.
No, he didn't deny it. Okay.
Okay. But it, but, and so after that, he committed suicide.
Yeah. Right, right.
Well, there's certainly a lot worse things that the Jews are doing with children, but they've managed through the media to point to everything that anybody can find about the Catholic priests, and some of it is bound to be true, but they've looked with the magnifying glass there, and
sure,
they don't look in other directions where it's going.
I do not know. Do you know the case of Father Bruce Ritter? Do you know anything about Covenant House in the big cities?
No, but I don't really want to get into that. I don't think.
Okay. But again,
go ahead.
Well, Father Bruce Ritter basically, they tried to trap him and they couldn't get anything. But it was the district attorney from New York who wired a punk, and they couldn't get anything on him. But again, that Covenant Houses, they were destroyed. He was destroyed. It was just horrible. So I wrote a letter to the editor about that. I sent you, it's very interesting about him. I will send you that letter.
Okay.
But I, you know, it bothers me with the Catholic Church. The best pope, modern pope the church had was Pius XII. And they don't dare to make him a saint, whereas they are going to make John Paul a saint. He was a schnook.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a publicity hog. He was a spendthrift. He probably was involved in the murder of Germans before World War II. You know, Bloody Sunday of Bromberg, that was 1939, yeah, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they are making him into a saint. Why? Because he crawled into, I don't say it now, but Israel. He was the first pope to recognize Israel as a state. That was John Paul. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so now they make him into a saint.
And they also want to do everything they can for the Poles to make the Germans look bad. I mean, that really is part of it. They want to keep raising up the Poles as, you know, in one way or another. And I'm not saying if they don't deserve it, it shouldn't be. But part of that is to make the Poles look good and the Germans look bad. That's just part of the political correctness of the World War II story.
Not only that. I mean, the United States wants to use Poland as they are going to have. I think they have rocket bases there in Poland now.
Now they're not going to do it, and then the Poles got mad. They decided they weren't going to do it, and the Poles got really mad because they thought that would make them more important to have those bases there. And it would bring the money too. Yes.
Yeah. And so the Poles are in, and the Germans are out. In spite of, well, because look, the Germans are. I mean, I have nothing. All I can say at this point, I despise the present day Germans. I mean, look.
Well, I know.
What do you say?
Well, I said I know. Yes, I do too. I do too. It's just really hard to take. It's very hard to take to see what's going on in Germany by Germans.
Yeah, yeah.
And
go ahead. There's a saying: when somebody kicks you in your butt that you almost croak, and you proceed to lick his boot, even the boot starts to vomit.
Well, they've all been put into place by the Americans, and they continue to have to be a certain kind of people, and it's with certain they have to do certain things in order to stay elected. But, and now the whole country has been kind of convinced that this is the way it has to go, or else they're going to be in terrible
danger. But not only that, Caroline, you have to remember that the Americans have atomic weapons stored in Germany. If the Germans don't do American biddings, well, a bomb might go off. And then you know what they are going to say? Oh, it was an accident.
And another thing is that there's without a peace treaty and without a conclusion of the war, they're still in a state of war, actually. And
sure.
And if the Germans don't do what they are supposed to do, if they would appear to be drifting back toward Nazism, then all the Allied governments have every right, according to their laws that they follow, to start war against with Germany again. I mean, and Germany can't defend itself. It has not been able to build up anything to defend itself with. So it's just totally a puppet, a completely helpless. So can't really blame these people, but I blame them for going along with it. Nobody should go along.
Well,
they
have
to bring in foreigners to run Germany.
Yes. I mean, look, they gave, when was it, 1956, they gave Churchill the Peace Prize, the Aachener Peace Prize.
Yes.
I mean, if that isn't low.
Yeah, there's another German I had on here a year ago, and he talked about that. That was just outrageous to him.
Yes. But by the way, I want to mention something about Pforzheim. My school friend had again a little girlfriend, and she was killed. What happened after Germany had been, after Pforzheim was destroyed, pulverized? Then the administration had areas where they handed out food to the people who had been bombed out and who still survived. So anyhow, a lone English airplane came. It was at Kupferhammer, and shot into the crowd. And that little girl was killed. She was about 12. So they killed about another 105 people. So they just mowed him down. That airplane mowed him down.
And this was when?
That was 2 or 3 days after Pforzheim had been bombed.
Mm.
So the crowd they came to these places where food was handed out. And so there was a big crowd there, and the airplane just mowed him down. One lone airplane.
You wonder how the German people could have forgiven all that as quickly as they did.
Well, I don't know.
You know, because they acted like they had so much fear of the Soviets that they just kept seeing the Americans as their friend.
Well, it's the media, you know. The Germans didn't have any media of their own. I mean, everything was taken over. The libraries were taken over. The school system was taken over. So newspapers, everything was taken over. So it was almost as if the ears and eyes, as if the eyes were poked out and the ears were cut off. So they had to see and hear everything with the eyes and ears of mostly the Jews, because they were put in charge.
Would you talk a little bit about Adolf Hitler and Christianity? You go into that quite a bit in this essay of yours. There is such a sense, even when people are told otherwise, that, well, there are a lot of stories that Adolf Hitler persecuted Christians and hated Christianity.
None of that is true. None of that is true. He paid his church tax to the very end. I know absolutely no persecution of Christians. Churches were built. I don't know where they are getting that from.
Well, they just make it up. Now here, You know, the church, the destruction of churches from the bombing went on was incredible. And these were old. And I really like, you know, I'm not that crazy about churches. But when I go to great churches, or when I was in Germany, I really loved the churches. Germans must love their churches because they make them so beautiful. And they have rebuilt all these churches. That's not meaning they're the same when they're rebuilt and redone. But they are nice. You know, the original old churches, all that destruction that was done is just, to me, it's unforgivable. It just should never be forgiven.
Well, I mean,
there's no reason for it.
No, for example, in Regensburg, the oldest church in Regensburg was a Schottenkirche, it's a Scottish church. And that was built about 900. That was destroyed. In Cologne, the oldest church in Germany, built around 800. That was destroyed. And the cathedral of Cologne was heavily, heavily damaged.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, in Pforzheim, I can send you a picture of all the churches destroyed and just destroyed. I mean, it was a war against a fellow Christian country. And this I don't quite understand. And the church doesn't want to look at it. I mean, I find the church so pathetic. I mean, I don't quite understand it. I mean, don't they realize that Germans, that the Wehrmacht and the Nazis saved the church? I mean, what would have happened if communism had won?
They can't say that, or they will be persecuted in the media, just like they have already done with the priest, you know, the priest persecutions for child abuse and so on, pedophilia. And they just pick that up again, and they can find any number of people to bring charges, kids to say things. They don't have any trouble doing that. So really, nobody is free in the world today, and we have to free ourselves. You know, I say all the time, I don't mind saying it, we have to free ourselves from under this Jewish power, under this Jewish control, in order to be free, because that's what it is. Now, you've got another part here in this article. About a book, Holocaust Denial, by Kenneth Stern. That was pretty interesting, some of the things you quoted from him. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well,
this is where the problem is.
Yeah. First of all, I want to come back when you said, do you mind if I backtrack a little bit?
No, go ahead.
Okay. First of all, you said we have to free ourselves. If we free ourselves, I think we also at the same time be free to choose. And I don't think they realize that, because I think so many Jews are just as much in bondage as we are. I think maybe I should write an article about that. It's not only freeing ourselves, it's also freeing the Jews from what shall I call it?
Well, I think you're right. It would free them, but I don't think it's our job to free them. And I'm not concerned about freeing them. I'm only concerned about freeing us. And if they can be freed in the, you know, as part of that, fine.
Okay. Okay. Now, what did you want? What do you want me to go talk about?
You talked about the book Holocaust Denial by Kenneth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Okay, Howard Stern wrote a book about Holocaust denial.
Kenneth Stern.
Okay, wrote a book, Holocaust Denial. And it's, by the way, I bought his book and I donated it to the library, because he gives all the revisionist authors. So it's anybody who wants to know something about revisionism, it's all right there. And actually he lambasts him. Okay. But anyhow, what he wrote in the preface, okay, that, what was the name
Zachariah Schuster.
Okay.
That's the memory of, yeah.
Yeah. Zachariah Schuster, okay, said he, with remember Vatican II, okay, that was in 65, it went over quite a few years, okay, said he, Zachariah Schuster, had an input in writing a proclamation. And that is, the proclamation is always put out in Latin, and it's Nostra Aetate, okay, in our times. And it's just, I mean, why would Catholics bring in a Jew to help them write a proclamation? I mean, how about turning it around? Can you imagine any Christian, a Jewish organization bringing in a Catholic or a Protestant to write any of their proclamation? No. So again, I mean, isn't that pathetic? I mean, I think it was pathetic.
Do you have any theories about why the church is so pro-Jewish now? I mean, it's not like we can't come up with some explanations for it.
Well, because what I just like I as a little girl, they want to be in, and to support the Jews is to be in. That's the only explanation I can have right now. Okay.
Well, I don't know how it makes them in, but
they follow the trend. Look, why do all the kids, why do the Catholic kids go to the, instead of going to a Catholic church, they go to the Holocaust Museum?
Yeah, well, they're told that that's what they should do, and they need to understand the great suffering. Yeah, you're right. But with the kids, at least, the kids, they can't think for themselves past what they're being told that well. Some can. And some do, but a lot of them, they're just not prepared to understand all of that. And so they've been told these things since they are in grade school. And so they tend to believe it. And I don't know how much they care about it, but they'll probably find it interesting. You know, they're probably interested in going to it, but adults are the same, though. Adults are like children in that they still just go along and believe what they're being told, what they've been told, and they don't think for themselves about it.
No, it's absolutely amazing this way the Jews hold over the Christian and the Gentile world. I mean, it's...
Well, we were talking during the break about now I have to get back to that because I can't even remember the name of Henry Ford article in the First Freedom newspaper. They are excerpting from the International Jew. Yeah, it says right at the top here, the International Jew, that Henry Ford wrote these segments in and published them in his Dearborn Independent. And the one that's in this February issue is 1921. Now he points out these are wonderful. I have never read The International Jew. I just never found the time to do it, although I'd always wanted to.
I have no idea either, but I will.
Well, I'm reading it in the newspaper here. I read last week. And he points out about this Kahila in New York that they organized, like before even 1900. I mean, they were coming over in waves as much as they could get Jews over here from Eastern Europe to New York in the 1890s and then the first part of the 1900s, and they just organized. They organized themselves so tightly, and this is why I tend to think that it is true that the average Jew is totally under the control and enthralled by these Jewish elites who organize all these things. And they have tons of organizations. And Henry Ford goes into detail in exposing or explaining how they did this, what they were doing, what their their rules were, because they published some of them at that time, or then he found out some of them, but how they did it. And this is how they managed to get all this power in this country, in other European countries too. But they really have it. They really went after the United States, and now they have it. And we're all like in the dark because we don't think the way they think. Well, yes. We've come to our break. We are going to take another 5-minute news break, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Today I'm talking to Mehdi Hassan, who's the senior political editor for the New Statesman magazine. We're going to be talking about the violence that's going on in Syria at the moment and also the developing situation in Iran. Mehdi Hassan, thank you very much for talking to me today. Now, we've seen observers being sent into Syria who seem to have done nothing to stop the violence. In fact, the death toll has risen from 20 to 30 people a day. How good do you think the observers are at implementing their mandate?
I do think they're very good, given how one of the leaders of the mission when it originally went in was a Sudanese general who's been accused of carrying out war crimes and ethnic cleansing in Darfur, which slightly hobbled both the legitimacy of the mission and the trust that a lot of Syrian opposition groups had in the Arab League mission. Since then, the Saudi Arabians have complained about the mission. They've pulled out their observers, they're pulling out their ambassador. I mean, the Arab League has really been all over the place on Syria. On the one hand, it's condemned Syria. It was praised for the first time condemning a fellow Arab nation and putting a resolution in a few months ago. Since then, its own mission has been criticised for, among other things, the personnel it's deployed and its inability to stop the violence. I think the real issue is that the Syrians need to allow in a much more neutral, a much more wide-ranging, a much more forceful international observer mission. If they've got nothing to hide, if they're genuinely not killing innocent people, then what have they got to hide?
And what about sanctions? The UK recently proposed tougher sanctions on Syria, things like travel bans, asset freezes. What effect, if any, do you think they'll have?
It depends how targeted the sanctions are. I'm always on the fence over sanctions, given the experience we had with Iraq for over a decade of sanctions, which caused more suffering to the people than to the Saddam regime. I support sanctions if they're targeted against regime members, if they're targeted against people who are indicted for human rights violations or war crimes, fine. If they squeeze the country itself and the people who've done nothing wrong, then I think that's a mistake. I think we have to think much more creatively about Syria. I'm not one of those who supports military action. Syria isn't Libya. It won't be easy. It won't be legitimate without a UN resolution. And more innocent people will die than have already died. But that doesn't mean you just turn a blind eye to the violence that's going on. More than 5,000 people have died, according to the UN's own figures. And Assad is a man who clearly is not backing down. You look at some of his interviews. You know, he's not as bonkers as Colonel Gaddafi. But he says some pretty crazy things about how it's nothing to do with me, not my orders. These are all armed rebels, everyone who's dying.
And let's talk about the opposition for a little bit. There appear to be three sort of distinct blocks. There's the Free Syrian Army, there's a kind of external opposition, there's people in the street. Do you think they'll be able to form any kind of cohesive group?
Well, that's one of the objections that a lot of people are having against any kind of external military action, which is, where is the legitimacy? In Libya, you had a opposition movement which, despite being consisting of different groups, secular, religious, etc., indigenous, and those outside the country, they did form a united opposition for the purposes of getting rid of Gaddafi. And they control territory. Benghazi, it's what prompted the intervention to begin with. In Syria, they don't control any territory, they don't control any cities or towns, and there is this division between the external opposition figures like the...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my guest tonight is Christine Miller. We're talking about a variety of things, and the call-in number that if you want to call in and join the conversation with us is 1-855-477-2283. Now, we were still on this Henry Ford excerpt in the First Freedom newspaper, and there's a lot that's interesting here, but we were saying during the break, Christine, that he points out here, goes through it very, very clearly and in lots of, not boring detail, but very interesting detail, how the Jews got control in New York City and then from there spread it out all around the country so that all, there were sort of like chapters or Jewish groups and organizations in every major city to begin with, and they all communicated back to New York and took their instructions from New York. And now they're in every little place that you can imagine. They're all over Texas. I mean, they're in every little town. There's always some Jews there, and they become quite influential, even though there might not be that many of them. Now, you're telling me that I want you to tell the listeners that Marshfield, your town, was founded by Germans, was always very strong.
No, I'm sorry. It wasn't founded by Germans, but it was put on the map by Germans.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Put on the map. All right. And then what?
Okay. Well, Marshfield would be nothing. It would be like a dinky little town, unimportant, but now it has a big clinic. The impetus to the clinic was given by a German, Dr. Degi. Bavarian nuns founded the hospital, and Weyerhaeuser founded the big door company. Produced wooden. Anything to do with wood.
Yeah, and people should be familiar with that name, Weyerhaeuser. It's things for the home, you know, things for home building and so on.
Right.
And these are all German names that you're mentioning.
They are all German names. So the Marshfield people make their living off these three major hospital, clinic, and Weyerhaeuser. And then we had a referendum here about 2 or 3 years ago, and they wanted to build a new school. The school board said, okay, it was written up in the Marshfield News Herald, if the referendum doesn't go through, we have to cut glasses. Well, take one guess which glass they would have cut.
Which?
Did you guess it?
Well, it could be several German glass, I think.
Yes. So the Spanish glass would have gone on, and the French glass. German would have been cut. I would say there was a...
And you were a teacher of German in the high school, right?
Yeah, Catholic high school. Okay. There was a random about 72% of the Marshfield population has a German background. I mean, if you look at the death notices, German names. If you look at the churchyard, German names. So, but again, who throws the biggest stone at me? Take a guess. The Germans. People of German descent.
Because you're making them nervous. Now, let's tell the listeners that you have, you sometime back ran for the school board, and you've been continuing to run every time there's an election, right?
Yes. Every year I run for school board. and
you haven't gotten, how many years have you been running for the school board?
I would say at least 10.
Okay. And you have never been elected.
No.
Even though you have very good ideas and you were a teacher.
Yes.
And you're quite, I think you're a very smart lady, and you've written, but see, you wrote all these letters to the editor, and you made, you told the truth, you talk about, you are the bravest woman I know, because in your hometown, you know, you get up and speak and say whatever you would say right here on this program, pretty much, and you're, but you're, I'm sure you're polite about it, you're a polite person, so,
yes.
And everybody there knows you. But the fact that you will speak out about Holocaust, about World War II, and even stand up for the Nazis in a way, you know, and try to tell the truth about it, they just can't handle that.
No, they can't. And again, they want to be with the winner. By the way, Carolyn, I'm not brave. I'm just old.
You are.
I'm 76. What do I have to lose? Okay.
Well, that's a great attitude. I wish more people in their 70s would take that attitude. We might
nothing to lose.
Well, as you told me during the break, and let's repeat it now, that not a single person in that town of all these Germans there stands up for you.
No. Publicly. They vote for me, let me see, last time I got about 800 and some 15 votes. One time I even got 1,400 votes. No, 1,400 votes. So that was the high point. And boy, was there an outcry by the Jews. I mean, Chris Miller, you know, got so many votes and she shouldn't get any votes.
So how many Jews are there? How many Jews are active in Marshfield?
Well, we have that's very interesting. We have at the university, we have a Jewish history professor. And, you know, I challenged Holocaust books at the Marshfield school libraries. And there was a committee. And one member has had to be a parent. And guess whom the committee picked?
The
Professor
Jew.
Kleiman.
Yeah.
Yes. And he was very, he told me, Chris Miller is now nationwide, blah, 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 blah. But so you see, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, Spanish is in, Jewish is in. German is out.
All right. We have a caller, Christine. So let's see what our caller has to say. Hello, who
okay.
are you? What's your name? And where are you?
Hey, this is Hadding in Florida.
Hey, Hadding. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, a lot of that stuff, the World War II propaganda against Germany, was just rehashed World War I propaganda.
I agree.
You can find propaganda from the First World War. Like, there's a book, I don't know, it's like Great German Thinkers or something like that. It's a very ironic title. And it has these shocking quotes from people like Friedrich Nietzsche, and represents these as thoughts of a typical German. So Americans will read something like God is dead, and they think, this is how all the Germans think.
Well, Hadding, what would you say about this kind of thing, like this spreading of propaganda and the way this is being done? Who would you say is responsible for that? Would you say it really is the Jews behind the scene responsible, or was it just these other countries, say the Anglo-Americans, basically? How do you
see? Well, there are two layers to the problem. The spear point of the problem is clearly Jews. The Jews own most, if not all, of the at least most important mass media, and they're very organized.
Well, we know that. I'm trying to get down a little bit deeper as to who is really responsible for this. Because now, Christine
deeper problem
says,
is.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the deeper problem is corruption in our own people.
Okay, because Chris is saying that she's running for the school board. She writes some letters to the editor, and nobody supports her. And then when it comes to putting somebody in a position of authority, they pick a Jew. Now, how does that happen? How does that Jew in a town like Marshfield? How many Jews are in Marshfield, Christine?
Well, Marshfield has a big clinic, okay, and a big big hospital. Again, as I mentioned, founded by Germans. But so there are quite a number of Jewish doctors here, and naturally, as I said, they are very active and very much in opposition to me. And they write the letters. When I write a letter, and they oppose me. But again, I mean, it's really, their letters are really, as far as I'm concerned, hilarious. But look, just about last year, we had at the Catholic high school, we had a Jewish coming in, and her name was Moses Kohl, and she claimed that she was a Mengele twin. Okay, Dr. Mengele. Yeah. And I have never, ever seen that high school auditorium so full. Mm-hmm. And naturally,
and
at
what
the
kind
end,
of people were in there? All these Germans were in there listening to that?
It was filled to the rafters. Naturally, the talk was advertised as forgiveness and reconciliation. And naturally, it had nothing to do with forgiveness and reconciliation. And at the end, let's talk about Jewish children. And at the end, when the audience could take the microphone, I was the first one to took the microphone, and I said, "Well, how about a candle for the German children? How about a candle for the Iraqi children and the Vietnamese children, and Palestinian children?" I tell you, there were some people in that audience who were ready to lynch me.
Now, were these? This is what I want to know.
Who were these Marshfield people, doctors, lawyers.
Were they Jewish people? Were they questionable people? Or were they just plain German people?
The Germans, okay. Marshfield.
I know that's true. I know that's true. But
there isn't a Marshfield. And they were ready to lynch me. And at the end, they were about to tear the microphone from my hands. And one more last thing said, "Look, I'm going to go now before, if I stay any longer, I'm starting to vomit." And then I handed the microphone over to them. But
you're trying to tell me that you're not brave? Now that is brave, Christine. That is super brave. I'm not that brave.
I'm just old. But I tell you, there were people in there who were ready to lynch me. So, and I've never, ever seen that auditorium. It was filled to the rafters.
Well, here's my take on this, is that the Jewish people who come into town and grow, and, you know, more and more of them, they are very active, actually aggressive, like you say. When you write a letter, they make sure they answer it and put down and everything. They're not timid. They're not quiet. They're not trying to be polite and get along. They're very active and aggressive. And the German people are not that way. You're an exception. So many Germans, I've complained about this. They are very, they want to be nice to everyone. They don't want to stand out. They don't want to cause trouble. They don't want to cause trouble.
Cause trouble, yes.
No.
On one hand, you know, you have to admire the Jews. They know what they want, and they are getting it, and they stick together.
That's what Hadding was saying.
What did you say?
That's what Hadding was saying, and that's why we need to figure this out. And going back to Henry Ford's international Jew, what he was saying about New York Jews, we need to be able to organize, but I don't know if we have the ability to do it. I don't see any,
as I said, I look here. You know, Carolyn, if I had one person who would publicly, you know, I thought about founding a German gov. Impossible. That's impossible. Nobody would join. Nobody would side by me. Mm-hmm. I mean, and again with the Jews, I mean, they organize, they stick together, in a way you have to admire them. I mean, and despise, and I mean.
Yeah, I don't mind people standing up for their own nationality or race or whatever. I don't mind that at all. I don't think Hadding does. So I don't argue with the Jews about that. I just say we should do it, and we should. But they want to call us names when we do it. But we shouldn't care about that. Why do we care about it? It's a kind of a person. It's a different sort of character and personality. And this is what the National Socialists were fighting. I don't like to use the word fighting, but they were having to deal with in the German people. And they were always trying to build up the German people, inform them, let them know what was being done against them, so they would get a little gumption and stand up against it. And they succeeded pretty well, but now we're back to way back again, you know.
It's absolutely pathetic. I mean, what is going on right now in Germany, the judiciary, the courts are completely corrupt. You know, I don't know, you know Günther Deckert. He was
yes.
on your show. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, he has been sentenced to five months in prison again.
Oh, I didn't know that was the latest. He said 5 months. I didn't know it would be that long. There was something that came up and they decided he had to spend more time in prison. He said he didn't mind. He was going to try to go in the winter so he could just do a lot of reading or something. But, I didn't know that.
He was translating a book by that translation, and then he was accused of disseminating it, but he didn't. But he was just translating it. And,
that's right. I keep getting that mixed up. And that was a long time ago, but they never really finished that off. And now they feel like, I guess, they need to punish him in some way. But they've dragged their feet on it. And now they're finally doing it.
Yeah, I see. 5 months. I got an email from him just the other day. So the sentence came down, sometimes February 1st or so, 5 months prison. And I don't know about any fines. But it's just the corruption in Germany by the judiciary is unbelievable.
So, well, let me just bring up this thing that just bugs the heck out of me, and that's this Zwickau terrorist cell that they are inventing and keep playing.
Yeah.
And two of these guys were killed, and now this poor woman, they're going to put her, they're probably going to put her, well, I don't know if they have the death sentence there, but they're going to put her away for life. If they can, they're trying everything, and they're trying to bring in other people and bring in the former members of the NPD. They're just trying to get rid of all of this, anything what they call neo-Nazi or right, far right, all together, and be able to ban it because they say they're trying to connect it with murder and terrorism, which is just a big scam as far as I'm concerned.
It's corruption, corruption, corruption.
Yes, it is. They're trying these people in the newspapers and I imagine on TV, and not in the courts. I mean, this woman no charges have even been brought against her, and they're talking about how guilty she is. And,
I'm not familiar with that case.
Oh, well, I've been talking about it and reading about it. Well, Hadding, are you still here?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, okay. What would you have anything further to say about this?
Yeah, I think that the case in Germany with the three nationalist terrorists, it shows the importance of keeping a distance from people that seem to be involved in illegal activity, because you can end up getting dragged into it when they get into trouble. I definitely wouldn't try to get away with anything like that, especially in Germany, because they seem to have a very efficient police system.
Yes, oh, but... okay, go ahead, Christine.
Yeah, by the way, what's your name again?
Hadding.
Okay, say it again.
Hadding.
Padding? Okay.
Padding, H-A-D-D-I-N-G.
Okay. Well, I want to mention a little bit about Nietzsche when he said, you know, Nietzsche, I don't know very much about his philosophy. Actually, I don't know anything about his philosophy. I try to read.
I think most Germans don't know anything about Nietzsche, really.
No, they don't. Because I tried to read also Sprach Zarathustra, and it didn't do anything for me. But Nietzsche wrote a beautiful poetry, okay? And he wrote one poem, and in this poem, it is a hymn to the unknown God. And if you ever can get that, then so you can see, they just know that one line by him, God is dead, but they don't know that that poem by Nietzsche.
Why don't you read it? Do you have it there?
The dem unbekannten Gott. Well, I don't have the translation. Okay, I would have to get my poetry book. But you can, if you cook, I'm quite sure. It's in the poem in German.
What was the sense of it? What was he saying? I know you sent it to me, but I don't remember.
Yeah. You don't read any Germans, but it's to the unknown God. And I tell you, in this poem, there's more religion than in most sermons. And so again, just to pick out that one thing, God is dead. You know, I don't even know where it appears. Do you know where it appears?
I'm not sure which book, but I mean, he was pretty consistent about criticizing Christianity.
Well, he was criticizing organized religion,
right?
And he didn't like the Christian story either. That's true.
Well, then again, I just had a quote by him the other day, and I agree with that. If you meet one of these religious men, you feel like you have to wash your hands afterwards. And at this point, I agree. Look, mm-hmm. I mean, don't misunderstand me. I owe a lot to the nuns in Germany. They housed and fed me and educated me for 5 years because my father couldn't pay. So I owe a debt to them. But at the other hand, what is going on now, it makes me vomit. It really is. It is sickening.
Yes, but what is far worse is what the communists did to the priests and nuns and so on in Russia, which you have written about. I mean, said that they was it even in this essay of yours.
And actually also what they did in Spain.
Yes, Spain. Yes. In Spain,
I mean, they dug up nuns, disinterred them. Their pictures there, okay, exhibited their half-rotten bodies, and I don't know how many priests were killed. It went into over 1,000, I think. Mm-hmm. And
then they want to focus on the Nazis putting priests in concentration camps.
Oh, I've got something to say about that. You know, the most famous Christian clergyman that had friction with the Third Reich was, of course, Martin Niemöller. Mm-hmm. And Pastor Niemöller. He was no liberal. You know, he had been a member of the Deutsche Nationale Volkspartei, you know, the real right-wing rich people's party. And he thought that the Jews were Christ killers. And Paul Rastignier.
Why did he get into trouble with the Third Reich? Was he the one who was complaining about some of their practices? Was he defending?
Well, what he see the thing is about Niemöller, he was a Christian fanatic, and he formed his own breakaway Protestant church that had Jewish baptized Jews as clergymen, and so he got in trouble with the government that way. And he spent a few years in Dachau.
We can't go on with that, Hadding, because I see that the time is, we're just about out of time, and I want to give a proper sign-off to Christine and to you also. I want to thank you for calling in. And I would like to say just real quick that Hitler tolerated Christianity quite totally, but he wasn't in love with Christianity, but he wasn't against it either. So that needs to be said. Christine, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Caroline.
All right, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, come back next week.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.